Hey guys, just a quick heads up, a large portion of tonight's show will have an interview component to it, thus some beep sounds between non-sequential thoughts. Now, I won't put these on before every show that we do an interview, but I want to give you all a fair warning for these first few. That said, I hope you enjoyed tonight's episode.
Hey everybody, this is Steven.
And this is Chris.
And we're the hosts of the brand new podcast, Is This Adulting?
Every week, we're going to sit down to have a discussion about life, culture, our own mental health struggles, and just about anything you can think of.
Have you ever wondered which breakfast cereal's the best?
Or how to help your friends who are dealing with mental illness?
Or why waterbeds were a thing?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then have we got a show for you.
And remember, kids, be happy, stay healthy, and go hug someone.
Because you never know, they might just be starting a podcast.
Welcome to episode 9 of Pints and Puzzles. I'm actually going to skip any ad breaks for tonight and just give you a quick reminder now to always remember to check out our partners over at FultonForLife.com for some great deals on some new handbags for the summer months coming up. With that housekeeping box checked, tonight we have a case that involves a plane crash, missing congressman, and a fantastic interview with an investigative journalist who spent years in the field uncovering some of these strange items surrounding the case. Tonight, we'll talk about the Begich Boggs disappearance.
What's a podcast? Find me a podcast. You're listening to You Miss Me to My Dad.
On October 16th of 1972, a Cessna 310 carrying four men, House Majority Leader Hale Boggs, Alaskan Representative Nick Begich, political aide Russell Brown, and pilot Don Johns, vanished without a trace in the Alaskan wilderness. Obviously, when two congressmen, especially ones as powerful as Boggs, disappear, there's bound to be an extensive investigation. And there certainly was. Military and civilian aircraft from all over the place, fishermen, even a CIA spy plane were all involved in a 39-day search for the group. Now, unfortunately, the search was not successful even to this day. But it's important to note here that Hale Boggs was an extremely powerful congressman that was a member of the Warren Commission, amongst other items, and is usually the talk when most conspiratorial corners of the interwebs look into this case. There's absolutely no shortage of both real and more speculative.
You know, for example, I found in the FBI file a single page about an incident in which Hale Boggs was run off the road in D.C. one night, and it was investigated by the D.C. police and the Secret Service, and there are no records of this except there's this one single page in the FBI file I got. I don't even know if that's connected, but I just thought it was an interesting thing to see because I didn't see that anywhere else before.
In addition to the Boggs angle, the son of Representative Begich, Nick Begich Jr., seems to be a fairly active, putting it lightly, in the conspiracy circles, and also has his own theories as to why his dad may have been the target of foul play. While the conspiracy angle is typically the sexy side of most cases, and certainly feeds much of our talks here, I did want to focus more on the disappearance angle and the factual side of things for tonight's discussion. However, I did want to acknowledge that I had read many of the fringe articles and would be more than happy to do a more speculative episode should the listener interest be there. So if you want to hear that, shoot me an email or a tweet and let me know. All of that said, there's the old adage that truth is stranger than fiction. And as cliche as it sounds, that surely was the case here as well. Some of the most extensive research I came across while researching this case myself was that done by investigative journalist John Walczak. John spent years doing a deep dive into this disappearance, and I was fortunate enough to have John agree to come on the show and talk about the case. full transparency here, we talked for about 3 hours, and there was definitely a lot to say that, frankly, we didn't put on the record. What follows, though, are clips from our conversation and some of the strange and interesting elements that John found throughout his years of investigating the case.
My name is Jonathan Walczak, and it's okay to record. I grew up and went to school in North Carolina. I have a journalism background. Started my career at a daily paper in North Carolina. I've also worked as a writer for a weekly paper, and I was an editor for MSN. Getting into journalism, I've always enjoyed investigative journalism. I love to take a story and find a million pieces of information and look at the parts of it that nobody's published yet, nobody's found, or nobody's connected. It's fun. I mean, honestly, it's fun to put the puzzle together. A story about two missing congressmen who vanished on a plane in Alaska at the height of Watergate. A story that not many people are, you know, very familiar with, if familiar with it at all. That just caught my attention. I mean, I'm very interested in history. I'm interested in politics. So it was kind of this just, in some ways, other than the big cases like JFK, it's the ultimate mystery. I mean, it's a missing plane with a very important congressman in Alaska that was never found. And then in addition to the basics, you had all these mysterious tips come into the FBI. And then, of course, later on, I found out just several times I almost gave up on the story and moved on. And right at those moments, I found information that kind of pushed me forward and kept me going. It's amazing because the source who told me the main things that make up the bulk of the new information that I published came about through a very random way. I contacted someone kind of on the periphery, not someone who I thought was very important to the story, and that person connected me to someone, and that person ended up being the source who kind of broke everything open to me.
So I wanted to break in real quick here and just make sure that you guys all know the key item that John found during his research. About 17 months after the crash, Nick Begich's wife married Jerry Max Paisley. Now, Paisley had mafia ties and definitely had a rap sheet for various items, including murder. So he finally did get arrested for one of these murders. And while in jail in the 1990s, he confessed to transporting explosives to Alaska. There are definitely other elements that John found that we'll mention in a minute, but that was the key item that he put together through his extensive research. And honestly, it was the main reason I looked at the story beyond just a regular missing persons or missing plane in Alaska. Anyway, let's get back to the story.
To think if there was a bombing, there would be attention, especially if the wreckage had been found. But everybody's attention would have been focused on Boggs, which it has been for years and years. Everybody would have said what they've said for years, which is, if anything, if it wasn't bad weather, if it was some kind of foul play, it wasn't this like glasses wearing friendly Alaska freshman congressman. I mean, why would he be the target? You know, I hard to get into speculation as to why, but in the story, I think people can read between the lines. I tried very hard in the story. I had the wedding certificate. I got photos of the wedding ceremony itself from an undercover investigator who provided the photos to me. That happened. I know the date it happened. It happened like 16 and a half months after the plane disappeared. I found documents regarding Nick Begich's life insurance policy and how much money went to his widow. I found things in the FBI files. So there's all this stuff that it just says, well, look, this man Paisley claimed that the missing plane was bombed. Was the missing plane bombed? I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. I'm not qualified to answer that question. I struggle with this because, I mean, I think the most likely explanation is the plane went down in bad weather. That's the explanation that was given. That's the explanation that was accepted, and that's the explanation that most people believe. But then you have all this other tangential and not tangential stuff. I mean, the fact that the widow of one of the men who disappeared, the widow of a missing congressman, married an admitted murderer and bomber for the mafia less than 17 months after her husband disappeared and she got more than $1 million in life insurance money and assistance from the government. And that man later told the FBI that he transported explosives to Alaska and named another man as the person who placed the bomb on the plane. That's just, I didn't believe it when I heard it. And I made sure to verify it. I talked to multiple people. I have documents. It's crazy, but it's a fact. I have the marriage license. I mean, Peggy Begich, who was Nick Begich's widow, married Jerry Mack Paisley. Paisley killed several people. He actually died in prison in 2010 from liver cancer. That's a fact. I mean, he murdered people. He went to prison for it. I think it's most likely the plane went down in bad weather, but there are a lot of unanswered questions in regards to the bombing claims. Having spent many hours and days and weeks and months immersed in this, something seems off to me. One of the interesting things about this story is how extensive the search was. To my knowledge, it's the largest search in American history. I haven't seen that explicitly said anywhere, but I haven't found any larger search. So there was obviously this big government search. They brought in top secret spy planes. They obviously used all kinds of aircraft to search. Then after the spy planes came in, they went over the film that they took. They had boats off the coast. There were civilian volunteers, both pilots and people like salmon fishers that were looking. It was just a massive, massive search. The other really fascinating thing is right after the plane disappeared, the night that it disappeared, there were, I believe, 5 or 6 ham radio operators in Northern California who claimed to hear a transmission of someone saying that they were a pilot in Alaska whose plane had crashed and that at least 1 or 2 people were alive. So those ham radio operators were actually flown to Alaska and then interviewed in Alaska to see if they were making it up. And what the government determined was that they were telling the truth, but the hypothesis was that what they heard, yes, while it was real, that it was somebody committing a hoax or playing a prank. I had several really interesting tips come in. I had a good number of people email me or contact me, and the most interesting tip by far that I got was, you know, a lot of people think they know where the plane crashed. A lot of people claim they know where the plane crashed, but I got a very credible tip as to where the plane might have crashed. And it was a very specific pinpointed area. Well, you know, I mean, obviously the holy grail of this story would be to find the plane, right? I mean,
right.
The crazy thing about Alaska is planes crash and then 40 or 50 years later, people find them. Basically, what I wanted is I wanted the reader to, rather than me tell them something, I wanted them to put together the story in their own mind. So here are the Legos, build the story. You have the ingredients now because of my research. Now you ask yourself what makes sense, even if there's a circumstantial case, you know, and again, it doesn't necessarily mean the bombing claim is true. It just means that there are a lot of questions that kind of, a lot of things seem off to me.
As I'm sure you've picked up by now, John made a concerted effort to stick to the facts, as it were. That said, the most popular theory seems to revolve around pilot error and bad weather.
The pilot was a very good pilot. He was also a kind of a daredevil. His name was Don Johns. There are pilots in Alaska to whom I talked who think that he was a little reckless, and then there are other people who think he was at the top of his game and they don't think he would have succumbed to bad weather. I guess it just depends who you talk to, but definitely the most prominent serious theory and the most likely. Everybody thinks the plane went down in bad weather. You know, I mean, to be honest, if I tried very hard in my writing to keep my opinions out of the story. So this is such a crazy story. And what I found is almost, I mean, it borders on absurd, although it's true, but I was very careful in how I reported the story and wrote. I would say most people believe the plane went down in bad weather. It's the fact that the weather was very poor the day the plane disappeared. It makes the most sense. So if you want to talk about speculation, there was a lot of speculation that the pilot, Don Johns, was responsible for the crash in part, not fully, but also the weather conditions. But that speculation isn't fair. And I tried to avoid all kinds of speculation, whether it had to do with the bombing claims, whether it had to do with pilot error. The fact is we don't know what happened because nobody found the plane. I would just say there are a lot of questions that there aren't answers to. So I would say, you know, what makes this case seem so crazy and what I found seem so crazy is the fact that we're talking about two congressmen. That now, if you imagine, for example, that there was a case where a husband disappeared, a widow remarried, and then the man she remarried later claimed that he played a part in the murder of her first husband, that doesn't sound crazy. But when you start throwing in the words plane, congressman, bomb.
Okay, so now that we've triggered every Echelon computer, in all seriousness, that might actually not be a bad thing in this case, as it seems the FBI originally didn't seem super interested in spending a lot of time on the case, at least comparatively to some of the other cases.
And what I wanted to happen when I published the story is for somebody else to pursue it, somebody like the FBI. Because the FBI, to the best of my knowledge, they had a very short, brief investigation into these claims in the 90s, and then they let it go. So, for example, the man who allegedly put the bomb on the plane, the man who was named by Paisley as the bomber, whether or not his claims are true, this man was, he's still alive. He was in Anchorage. He was interviewed by the FBI for, I believe, 45 minutes. So the FBI didn't take Paisley's claims seriously. I don't know why. I mean, I can speculate, but which is interesting because previously Paisley was an FBI informant. So his information was good enough when the FBI wanted it, but when he raised an issue that maybe they didn't really want to look into, then all of a sudden became not a credible source. So I have the former head of the Anchorage PD homicide unit, an Alaska state trooper, and a longtime investigator from Arizona who worked for the state. All three of those men went on the record, which is rare. Two of them expressed very serious concerns about the lack of a follow-up investigation to me. This isn't just me saying this. These are very well-seasoned investigators with decades and decades of experience saying, you know, we passed this information to the FBI and the FBI didn't follow up on it like they should have.
I agree with John that there definitely could have been a multitude of reasons for the FBI to have done a shorter than normal investigation. I mean, Alaska's a big state and definitely planes disappear there a lot. But they weren't the only ones to have lack of follow-up.
I'd say there wasn't as solid of an investigation done as possible for a few reasons. One, it was a very busy news cycle, Watergate, Vietnam. The attention of the nation turned elsewhere pretty quickly. Two, the bombing claim wasn't known to anyone in law enforcement or the media until the 90s. And then the third thing, which is the title of my story is a play on words. So four gone, four people disappeared. That's how it's spelled. But I also did that as a play on foregone, as in foregone conclusion. Mm. It was a foregone conclusion. It disappeared in bad weather. I would say when you have a very realistic explanation as to why the plane vanished, which, again, could actually be why it vanished and is the most likely explanation, people had a foregone conclusion as to what happened to it. So when you think you know what happened to something and you're pretty confident about it, you have less of an incentive to dig into. It's crazy to me that not a single outlet in Alaska has reported this. You don't have to say the plane was bombed to say that there were claims it was bombed by someone with very close ties to someone who went missing. And the fact that there was an investigation by multiple law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, that the Alaskan press is aware of this, trust me, I've contacted basically everybody up there, and that not a single one of them, despite documentation and on-the-record facts and on-the-record sources, none of them will look into it. None of them will report it. I'm not asking them to say the plane was bombed because I don't say the plane was bombed. I'm asking them to do their damn job and report the facts at the very least, because the power of the local press is still relatively strong. Power of the Alaskan press is probably greater in this story than even the power of the New York Times. I'd like to see somebody in Alaska in a position of power, whether that be government, law enforcement, or media, give a shit, because the people that care are average citizens. And to be fair, certain members of law enforcement that I talk to, for example, take the tip that I got about where the plane is located. And I understand they got many, many tips, but there's a very specific one that if asked by the government, I mean, I would give it to them so that they could go look. I would love for somebody to pick up on this. Just how crazy it is that nobody pursued this further, that, like I said, the title of the book, people had a foregone conclusion in their head. Plane disappears in Alaska. There's bad weather. The plane went down in bad weather. Time to move on. And that was about as far as it got in the 70s. And then in the 90s, you had these claims of a bombing. And then there was a very short investigation, and it didn't go anywhere.
Clearly, some things were missed in this case. Whether it's the lack of follow-up on the FBI or the media coverage, bottom line is there were four men that went missing that day. And it's really important to myself, as well as to John, to keep the impact of the families in perspective.
And that's something that I took very seriously, is that, you know, the people who disappeared, they have kids. A lot of their kids are alive. These are their fathers. I mean, you know, you're a father. I mean, if God forbid something ever happened to you, you know, you wouldn't want somebody taking this lightly. You know, your kids would want answers. And that's something that I do feel a responsibility to the story. It's something that interests me, but it's also something that I see nobody else really pursuing. So I feel like if I don't pursue it, as people die off, so goes the story, so go the answers. And the kids are really the ones who suffer here. You know, the family members that were left behind. I mean, the Cokie Roberts, yes, she's a celebrity, but she's a daughter. I mean, she lost her father, and her father's body was never recovered, and she doesn't know exactly what happened to her father. So that's the way I think to look at this. These were people, and we focus on the congressman, as we should. That's why it's newsworthy. But it's also really important to focus on the other two guys. There was the political aide and the pilot, and I talked, for example, with the pilot's ex-wife, and she explained to me just what an impact this had on his son. They were divorced, the ex-wife and the pilot. Don Johns, his son, Aaron, Aaron's mom, I interviewed her in Colorado, and it gives a human perspective. You can go into like, oh, there's this and facts and a missing plane and congressmen and, you know, theories about what happened. But then you talk to someone and realize that it was somebody's son who was very, very young and who grew up not knowing what happened to their father, you know, and in some ways it was worse for the families of the political aide and the pilot because all the attention went to the congressman. They were left wondering. And I know I talked to the ex-wife of the pilot, and as the mother of his only child, she kept trying to get updates about the search, about what was going on, not just because she cared about him, but mainly because she cared about her son. And she just told me what a difficult time she had getting answers and how people wouldn't call her back, whereas a lot of attention was paid to and care given to the families of the congressmen because of who they were.
Lastly, I asked John what he'd like to do with the info as next steps. And of course, I made him plug his website for you all to check out and of course donate to if possible.
Well, I'd say what I would like to do with this story is either turn it into a book or a documentary. It's a very visual story, so I think it could work well for film. I would like to put it into a format that will reach more people rather than the way that I presented it already, which was basically just to go on the record with the facts. So I'd like to do a book that's accessible or a documentary that's accessible. And I mean, my dream scenario would be to go look for the plane in the location that somebody gave me a tip about. I would also like to talk to a good number of people who wouldn't talk to me the first time around. Now, I understand in large part why people would be hesitant initially to talk to me. The families, for example, because they've been contacted by a lot of crazies over the year. But I would hope now that they see that I approach this very soberly and carefully, that they would be open to talking with me.
Do you want to plug the website?
Yeah, it's haleboggs.com, haleboggs, boggs.com. I had the story listed for $2, and I made it available for free. Or it's actually a pay what you want model now. So I'm more interested in spreading the information and disseminating the story than I am in making money. So if people are interested in reading the story, feel free to go check out the website. And if you want to pay, that's wonderful. If not, that's fine too.
Well, that'll do it for our interview tonight. I sincerely want to thank John Walczak for agreeing to talk with us tonight. It's clear the amount of effort and work he put into his research, so I certainly encourage you all to check out his work. And if you want to reach out to him, there's contact area on his website at hellbogs.com, where you can reach him through that. Before we go into our beer review for the night, I'm sure you're all wondering what I make of all the information that John shared. So I absolutely think that the plane crashed, and that's undisputed. The most common sense way of interpreting this is the plane crashed in bad weather. However, John did uncover a lot of really important key factors, and even though his work is more factual rather than speculative, I think one can paint an interesting picture. Of course, it's up to you guys and readers of the article to make their own interpretations on the event. I will say, any way you cut it, there's a lot of strange things that occurred that may or may not have had to do with this case. As I mentioned multiple times, I know John stuck more to the facts in his extensive research. However, I freely admit to going down some more speculative rabbit holes that point to some conspiratorial reasons why both Boggs and Baggage, for that matter, could have been targets. Two-for-one deal, perhaps, by the government? Who knows? I don't know for sure, but I do encourage anyone that has the curiosity bug to do some research on their own, even if it's just Googling, and form their own conclusions.
There is curiosity. And the people that are listening to your podcast and the people that are interested in these cases in general, they're curious people. They're interested. And, you know, so I would say every single person listening to this, you're a curious person, or you wouldn't be listening to this, or you're related or a relative. For the most part, you're probably a curious person. So, you know, there's this was my story, but there are, I was amazed that of all the stories I could have chosen, I chose the stories where I found just some crazy, crazy stuff. And I wonder how much of that is I just got lucky in choosing the story, and how much of it is there are a lot of other stories out there that nobody has taken the right amount of time to pursue. And if you dig deep enough, you'll find some interesting things.
So for tonight's beer review, we are reviewing the Serrano from Round Guys Brewery in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. Yes, it's another Philly suburban beer. What can I say? I like supporting local when possible. So, the beer itself is a Saison style, which honestly always bothered me as sounding too pretentious. So, I usually just go with farmhouse style. Interesting backstory on the farmhouse style. It was actually made in the winter for farmhands to drink it the following summer. As such, it was usually a slightly higher ABV, but still light enough to drink in the summer months. While that was an interesting side note and mini tangent for a beer review, this actually matches the style of the beer spot on. So it has a little more hoppiness to it, I would say, than an average Saison or farmhouse style. Another funny aside, this beer actually tastes like it's about a 4 or 4.5 beer, but it actually comes in closer to a 7 or 7.5, which would explain a lot the first couple times I tried it. but nonetheless, it was delicious. Taste-wise, there are some mango notes here, and the label says sour cherry, which I didn't really get as much, but I definitely get it on the smell, not as much on the taste. Like I said, the hops are there too, which is a nice touch, and it's a really great rounded beer all around. As far as Round Guys goes, they are what I'm calling my karmic brewery. Let me explain here in a minute. So I actually picked up the Serrano completely randomly at a local garden store where they were giving out free samples. So to top it off, I also ran into them again last Sunday at the Brewfest down in Philadelphia. So it's kind of funny how life works like that. But definitely a brewery that I want to keep an eye on, and I encourage you guys all to keep an eye on if you're in the general Philadelphia area or Philly suburbs. By the way, while at Brewfest, I tried their Loving the Alien. That was an awesome beer. But, well, that's for another show. Have a good night, everyone.
That was pretty awesome. That was totes amazing. Growers. That's really great.
Great.